This is a HeadGum Original.
Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
A few years ago, when I was developing this podcast, there were two pieces of negative feedback that I received. One of them was, "This concept won't stretch beyond 4 or 5 episodes. You're going to run out of ideas." My response to that was to immediately jot down 20 ideas for episodes just off the top of my head. And maybe they found that more annoying than impressive, since most places still rejected it. And here we are, at episode 30. Okay, what do we got? What do we got? Tom Hanks in the new Elvis movie trailer. Still got to do a Marvelous Mrs. Maisel episode. That's on the back burner. Oh, Tom Hanks cameo in the Simpsons movie. I could talk to people who've been on the Simpsons. High School Musical episode. Great. Okay, for this one, I'm going to travel back in time to 1990, 1974, and 1949. But we're going to start out in the present, with me talking to the songwriting duo perhaps best known for writing the Oscar-winning song from Frozen, "Let It Go," which is a phrase that people sometimes say about this podcast.
Can I ask, when you were 24 and this whole Dead Eyes moment went down, had you...
This is Kristen Anderson Lopez, Oscar, Grammy, Emmy award-winning songwriter.
Had you been trained for film acting versus stage acting?
I remember I had watched the Michael Caine acting in film video. I had seen, he did like that masterclass in the 80s where he was talking about how you should treat the camera a certain way.
"Now, you see actors and they're acting and they change eyes as they're talking. Can you see my eyes changing here? Yes. Just I'm changing eyes."
And this was information you had going into Band of Brothers.
And this is Kristen's husband, Bobby Lopez, who is an EGOT, meaning he has won an Emmy, Grammy, Oscar, and Tony. Although that's misleading, because he's actually the only person in the world who has more than one of each.
I had eye-based film acting.
From Michael Caine,
knowledge,
no
yes. So it was a thing I'd thought about.
Because I know what I would have done. I would have been like, "Hello," and jazz hands and made it super big and have like giant double takes. I would have made a lot of that scene with the most alive eyes I could.
At the time, I probably thought I knew a lot, but I don't think I did know a lot about film acting. I knew it was different, but I also didn't have experience or, you know, a skill set that I knew I could rely on at that point.
Did you call back to the moment you played... What was his name? Buzz Adams? What's
Lieutenant
his name?
Buzz Adams. I truly never thought about Buzz Adams after I did that production. I certainly did not think, in my prep work for the role of Private Zelinsky, I never thought, well, I've done World War II before. I didn't make the connection back then.
In 1990, a decade before I lost the role of Private Zelinsky in Band of Brothers, I was a freshman in high school, and I was cast in a small speaking role in the Jefferson City High School spring production of South Pacific, the Rodgers and Hammerstein musical that takes place on a Pacific island during World War II. I had a couple of scenes with dialogue, in addition to performing in various musical numbers as a member of the ensemble.
Now, but wait a minute. So were you in Nothing Like a Dame as an officer?
Yes, and I specifically remember, I think I was probably kind of annoying to the directors of that production, because I remember going to the director and saying, I'm a lieutenant. Why am I hanging around with these sailors? I specifically, and they're like, it doesn't matter. You're just part of the ensemble in this one. You're, I wanted to know, am I the same character or am I a different character in this scene?
I think that's a great instinct for a real professional. Maybe not a 14-year-old, but
I knew I was being annoying as soon as I asked the question because they were not they were not interested in my process.
Buzz Adams is not a big role or a particularly memorable one. A description that might sound kind of familiar to longtime listeners of this podcast.
That is sort of the Zelinsky of South Pacific, certainly in the stage version.
Yeah.
He has one scene in an office. He comes in. He talks a little bit more than Zelinsky, but it basically is the name of the character is probably more memorable than the what he actually does in the play.
The thing that got me thinking about my Buzz Adams experience was when I learned about another production of South Pacific from 1974 that took place at Skyline High in Oakland, California, with a specific high school senior playing the show's comedic leading role, Luther Billis. That young actor's name was Tom Hanks.
Right,
Honey
right.
Bun. The funny part, yeah.
Yeah, honey bun.
I'm speaking of my sweetie pie.
Alice, get off the stage!
16 inches long, 40 inches packed with dynamite. 101 pounds of fun. That's my, although the Nelly gets to sing it, he just gets to dress like a woman with coconuts on his boobs.
And there's a photo. I found a photo of Tom Hanks in this production. I'll send it to you where he's wearing the coconut bra and the grass skirt. This was the part I desperately wanted as a freshman. I did not get it. I did not get the role. And it also makes sense because freshmen typically did not get main roles in the High School Musical.
Sure.
No, yeah. That's a kind of a rule to this day in high schools all over America. That's where you pay your dues. That's where you're a private Zelinsky.
A World War II musical in which Tom Hanks got the part I wanted and I wound up stuck in the Zelinsky role? In high school, maybe the time when acting rejections feel the most personal. Running out of ideas. Can you imagine? They really said that.
This is Dead Eyes, a podcast about one actor's quest to find out why Tom Hanks fired him from a small role in the 2001 HBO miniseries Band of Brothers.
My name is Connor Ratliff. I'm an actor and comedian. 22 years ago, I was fired by Tom Hanks. The reason I was told at the time was that he had looked at my audition tape and he thought that I had dead eyes.
And it's just as entertaining as Serial. It's like, there was sort of a murder. I mean, from your point of view.
A career was briefly murdered and then resuscitated.
And that's the short version.
Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort, meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
The musical South Pacific was based on James Michener's book of short stories, Tales from the South Pacific, which was published a mere 2 years after the end of World War II. Richard Rodgers and Oscar Hammerstein adapted the disparate stories into one interconnected narrative, wrote more than a dozen songs, and created a Pulitzer and Tony Award-winning classic that audiences loved. It's a serious musical with a complicated history. Originally, it was controversial for what was, at the time, a fairly progressive anti-racism message. But there are also aspects of the show that have aged badly, including some particularly ugly and offensive stereotypes.
Well, that's right. That's the problem with the huge, long-running Broadway shows. They're not set up to be changed by the people that made them. They get done every night. They're supposed to stay the same. There's people in charge of keeping it the same every night and making sure that the actors don't migrate in their performances too far away from opening night.
I haven't had the privilege of watching the same show for 5 years every night, but some stage managers have, and they do notice the way things shift and change, the way that certain laughs start to play very different than they did 3 years ago. And I think that if you are an actor who can do that, really, you have to go out and sell this line every night. You do have to also be mindful of, like, how am I selling it? Am I selling it using tropes and stereotypes, or am I selling it like I'm going to be aware of what's going on in the culture right now and find a way to add that layer?
One of the most dramatic moments in South Pacific is when the show's romantic lead, French expatriate Emile Debec, reveals that he is a widower and that his late wife was a Polynesian woman with whom he had several children. His new love interest, Nellie Forbush, reacts more forcefully to this news than she did when he told her about how he fled his home country after killing a man he claimed was the town bully.
And I remember watching that movie on TV with my parents and wondering, what's the problem? Because I am biracial myself. My parents are, you know, my dad is Filipino, my mother is white. And they had to sort of explain it to me, and it still didn't fully make sense because it felt so normal. I mean, it's a weird moment. Even in the 80s, it was like, what?
You've got to be taught to be afraid of people whose eyes are oddly made and people whose skin is a different shade. You've got to be carefully taught.
South Pacific's most controversial song, You've Got to Be Carefully Taught, was intended to unpack that racial prejudice is learned behavior that can therefore be unlearned. I barely remember this song from the production I was in. It's short, but listening to it now, the thing that jumps out at me is the way the lyrics casually undermine the song's message.
Why did they say oddly instead of differently made?
Mm.
From a complete patriarch, like a complete white guy who probably was just thinking differently has too many syllables. So I'll put oddly.
And the people that created musical theater, synthesized the elements into musical theater, were mostly Russian Jewish immigrants, or the children of them, who were running towards whiteness themselves and trying to make a place trying to join the American dream and create American art form that synthesized different cultures. And that's what musical theater was. Musical theater is a synthesis and cultural appropriation of different things by Russian Jewish immigrants as part of an effort to join whiteness, which I think is why I ran toward it so fiercely. I was very much, I had a lot of Asian self-internalized hate.
Because your parents made you watch South Pacific when you were little. And
yeah, I was carefully taught by South Pacific.
You're the reason Nellie Forbush cries and says, I can't be with that guy.
My eyes are oddly made. Jesus Christ, I better get some kind of gig here. And yeah, I think that's definitely why I write the kind of music I write.
In addition to being ambitious, controversial, and in places problematic, the main thing that South Pacific has been over the course of the past 7 decades is popular. So in some ways, it's not surprising to learn that both my high school and Tom Hanks's mounted productions over the course of multiple decades.
They did it in my elementary school when I was in third grade, and the sixth grade class did it. And that was one of the shows that made me love musicals.
Somehow I missed it. And I'm glad, because there's really only 3 featured women parts. There's mm-hmm. only Nellie, Bloody Mary and Liat.
Right.
And Liat doesn't even get to talk, really.
Yeah.
It's a really bad choice for high schools because usually the bulk of the cast are girls who've been waiting their whole life to get to be in the musical. And suddenly they're looking for all the boys who don't feel safe to sing and dance up on stage, and that you can't get enough boys to actually make it worthwhile. Unless you have a different high school than other high schools in America, I think.
Unfortunately for me, there were enough boys at Jefferson City High School that wanted to be in the musical that no one was begging me to please play the role of Luther Billis. I auditioned for it, but I knew it was a long shot. And I have to say, I was not surprised when the role went to an upperclassman, a junior at the time, named Jonathan Craighead. He still lives in Jefferson City, and he's a doctor now, an orthopedic surgeon.
I kind of had a connection with it because the last time our high school had done it in the 70s, my uncle Keith had actually played the part of Billis. And so there was kind of this family connection of, you know, this role's been done before by your uncle. And so that was kind of the role I was going for and was hoping to get.
What did your Uncle Keith think of your interpretation of Billis?
He's my uncle. What's he going to say, right? So I think he was very flattering. It was fun just because it carried on a family tradition. Billis is an interesting character in that he's kind of that character you see in every military base or even like prison type film, that he's the guy that can get you stuff, right? He's kind of the guy that, you know, has access to the contraband and can work things behind the system. I'd like to think that I did the part justice, but hopefully there's no existing tapes.
Unfortunately for Jonathan, there were tapes at his mom's house. These VHS tapes were so old and damaged that they almost destroyed two machines being used to digitize them. It's weird watching this footage, something I really never expected to see. I look like a child standing next to Jonathan in our first scene together, me dressed in a sailor suit like a little boy while he's towering over me, walking around with his shirt open and his sleeves rolled up, showing off all the upper body muscles that I will never develop. It is immediately obvious to me that it would have been a terrible idea to cast me as Billis.
Why, you big phony? We all know why you want to go over to Valley High.
Why?
Because the French planters put all their young women over there when they heard the GIs were coming.
I don't know if you've looked at this in a long time, but this would be your junior year, high school yearbook, my freshman year. I found a quote where it says, Junior Jonathan Craighead said, I like chorale because we get out of school a lot and you really get to know everyone. Working with Mr. Burkle is great. He has such an awesome knowledge of music. I think that's a really honest quote from a high schooler.
You know, the nice thing is, so when we'd go and do shows, especially with chorale, a lot of times at the venue, we'd have to go and set up the bleachers and the sound equipment stuff. And so he'd always pick, you know, a few of the upper class boys to go do this. And so you'd go and you'd set it up, but then you'd also break it down. And sometimes it took a long time to break that equipment down, Connor. I mean, you know, you may not make it back to school that day. And so
that sounds like a very Luther Billis type impulse, because Luther Billis is sort of the character's like main trait is like figuring out schemes and figuring out how to bend and break the rules.
He's definitely a schemer. That's exactly right. I remember we had a cast party afterwards. I think it was at Mr. Burkle's church, and we had a DJ, and, you know, they had sub sandwiches, and, you know, it was a lot of fun afterwards. So
I don't remember the party. I think there's a reasonable chance that I was not at that party.
You probably couldn't get a ride.
I also was not, a big party person in high school or ever.
Well, this was a sanctioned party. This is the after production party. So there it was a pretty safe party. It was you know.
Do you remember the part that I was in the There's Nothing Like a Dame musical number, but then
yeah.
I had a part where I was Lieutenant Buzz Adams. Do you remember that scene?
I don't.
It's a real small scene.
You know, when you sent me the email, you know, your name was familiar, and then I actually grabbed my old yearbook from that year and looked you up, and I was like, yeah, I remember Connor, you know, I remembered your association with your parents and him being the weatherman and, you know, you being friends with Jeff Falzone and being involved in theater and stuff. And so I don't remember all of the specific scenes that we did, you know, throughout it. I mean, I kind of remembered you being in one of the other guys on the base and can I quote specific dialogue? No.
Well, sir, we've been out about an hour. It was still dark, I know. That's when Luther, this fellow here, that's when he left the ship.
At age 14, I already knew that I wanted to be a professional actor someday. So I sort of viewed every play I did as a kind of training for that. For Jonathan, being in a play was just one small aspect of his teenage years.
How do you know how far to push the boundaries to go for it, right? I mean, when do you say enough is enough and I'm going to take the safe road, or when do you say I'm going to keep going? And so during high school, I you know, participated in sports and then also in theater, chorale, you know, the musicals. But that kind of, other than, you know, maybe an occasional speaking role in a church production or something like that, I didn't do any theater in college or advance it at all. And so that was kind of the end of my theater career, if you will.
I was very aware that you were in the play, but that you were also an athlete. And that was a world that I was not able to straddle those two worlds. Everything I did had to be in the performing or humor category because I was not physically capable of being good at any sports.
But you had, I mean, you had friends that were athletes and in other groups. It wasn't like you just hung out with theater kids. I mean, you had a wide group of friends.
Yeah, because I was friends like Jason Abbott and Jeff Falzone. And it was actually a lot of more soccer people than, I don't know how many football people. Did Derek Hurst play football?
I can't remember.
Are you a Tom Hanks fan?
Yeah, I am. Yeah. I mean, who doesn't like Tom Hanks, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I think it would have been interesting to see his interpretation of Billis, you know, in high school. I'm sure that probably doesn't exist, but I would have liked to have seen it. One of the things that when I'm thinking about him playing that role, I think from just a character standpoint, he'd be good because he could kind of do the gruff part, soft part, kind of like, you know, League of Their Own, that character really well. And that's some of what Billis needs. But just from a physical standpoint, I mean, every time I've ever seen Billis portrayed, he's kind of been, you know, a bigger, stouter guy, more muscular. And my guess is, just based on probably the earliest I remember seeing Tom Hanks would be like Bosom Buddies. He probably had a fairly skinny frame in high school and just physically doesn't seem to fit the part. But I'm sure he did fantastic with it.
It's easy to speculate about how good Tom Hanks must have been as Luther Billis. But I wanted to hear from people who were actually there at the time. To that end, I went looking to see if I could find anyone who was involved in the 1974 Skyline High production of South Pacific. And like any modern amateur sleuth with limited resources, this involved getting trial memberships for a number of websites. I'd already found a couple of black and white photos of young Tom Hanks as Billis online, showing him wearing the iconic grass skirt with coconut bra. And there are a lot of articles about Tom's connection with Skyline, but most of them are about nice things he's done for the school, giving money to renovate the auditorium, recording a special graduation message for the class of 2020, etc. Not a lot about South Pacific. But then,
I tracked down a digital copy of the 1974 Skyline yearbook, which had a bunch of other photos from the production. And those photos had captions. There were names. Tom's was spelled T-H-O-M back then. Once I had a list of people who were at Skyline in the 70s, I started reaching out.
Hello?
Hi, is this Elise?
It's Elise, and this must be Connor.
Hi, this is Connor. Very nice to speak with you.
This is Elise Dukatz, former dance instructor at Skyline High, who did the choreography for many productions over the years, including 1974's South Pacific. She worked at Skyline until 1992, and for the past few decades has been a senior fitness instructor. During the pandemic, she's been conducting her classes over Zoom, but our interview was over her landline phone. And before I got around to asking Elise any questions, she wanted a few answers from me.
So tell me, why are you doing this? What is the goal?
When I found out that Tom had been in South Pacific when he was in high school, I thought, oh, that's so interesting because I was in South Pacific in high school 15 years later.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, all right, stop a minute.
Yeah.
TMI.
Yes, a lot.
So where do you do these podcasts?
Well, I record them just sort of wherever I'm at, but then they get released online. So if you Google...
Okay, do people listen to your podcasts?
Yes, they do.
How do you access it? I mean, say if you have a computer, how do you access that particular podcast?
I have an app on my phone.
I didn't say phone. Did I say phone?
You didn't say phone.
Okay, I don't want to hear about phone.
Okay.
Because I don't have a smartphone.
All right,
Elise was very generous with her time and justifiably skeptical about why I wanted to speak with her.
Connor, okay. You didn't quite answer my original question.
Yes.
You gave me lots of information.
Yes.
This particular podcast that we're doing right now, I imagine that's what it is. The purpose is, in one sentence.
The purpose of this is I'm exploring the connection.
I could definitely tell that Elise was a teacher, as I have not had a conversation with this dynamic in decades.
And I'm fascinated by the fact that we also share an experience of doing a World War II related musical when each of us was in high school.
That's more than one sentence.
It's a run-on sentence with a... I put a semicolon in the middle of it.
So it's a personal thing. Okay. But you're not really friends with Tom Hanks.
Part of the goal is I would like to eventually talk with Tom Hanks.
Okay, and how do you get paid for these podcasts? I mean, radio, you know, has sponsors.
Yes.
And so the radio broadcasters, you know, get paid because they're sponsors. I mean, unless you're doing it just for the fun of it.
That's a great question. This podcast is on what's called a podcast network. And they do get sponsors and advertisers to help pay for things like that.
Elise and I will return after a short ad break. Dead Eyes will be right back.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
How many years did you work at Skyline?
I taught at Skyline for 23 years.
Wow.
And we did a musical every year. And when Tom was at Skyline, and when I first came for about the first, 10 or 15 years, we had an incredible performing arts department. We did Oklahoma, we did West Side Story, I know that, we did Cabaret.
And you're naming different musicals, each one requiring completely different sort of dancing styles.
Exactly, and that's true. So 23 years, I can't remember all the 23 musicals that we did, but...
Sure, well, I'm not going to quiz you, don't worry. What is it like when you're working with someone who hasn't danced before and you're having to sort of build them from scratch?
The kids who were in the musicals wanted to be there. And so they were great to work with. I mean, you could give them something and they would do it. It wasn't like, you know, I don't want to do this. I mean, it was prestigious to be in a musical. I'm sure you probably knew that too.
Oh, yeah.
It was competitive.
You said you taught Tom Hanks how to dance.
I did. Because he wasn't a dancer. But there are a couple of dance numbers, not really dance numbers, but movement numbers that Lieutenant Billis does. And so, yes, I taught Tom Hanks how to dance.
Yeah.
He was open to learning. And he, you know, he was a mover.
Right.
I mean, you can try to teach somebody who isn't really a mover, and that's a little different, but Tom was pretty easy to work with.
Do you remember the scene in the movie Big where he's dancing on the with Robert Loggia on the piano in the toy store?
You know, I'm not sure I saw that movie.
You're going to treat yourself if you haven't seen the movie Big. It's a very fun movie, and it's even if you just watch that scene, it's a classic scene, and it's him dancing on the piano keys. It's not really dance in the traditional sense. It's more like...
Yeah, I think I've seen that, but it's been a long time ago. I think I've seen that particular scene where he's on the keys, on the piano keys, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, I think you have a little bit, you can take a little bit of credit for that moment. As the person who taught him to dance on stage, it came in handy. It created a classic moment in cinema. Did you have a sense when you were working with him that, this kid's really talented?
I would say yes.
You sound hesitant. Was there any doubt?
No.
No.
No. But, I mean, he was just one of several talented kids that there were, you know. All right, well, it's been fun.
Yeah.
And I'll be listening or hearing from you about this podcast.
All right. Well, stay safe. Be well.
Good luck on everything and your drama career.
Thank you.
Okay.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Bye, Elise.
Elise ended up being the easiest person to track down from Skyline's South Pacific production. My producers and I went through yearbooks, college alumni offices, newspaper archives, birth certificates, marriage certificates, messaging random people on Facebook again. And after all that, we were finally able to get one student to talk with us. Kip Lacer, Skyline class of 1974. Were you a senior in high school when you were in it?
Yes, I was.
Were you in the ensemble or did you have a part in it?
I was in the ensemble like you. I might have had a couple of lines here or there, but I was more in the ensemble than I was a lead.
What are your recollections when you think back to being in that production?
Senior year, I'd been a thespian from starting right out in my sophomore year, so now in my third year. Tom Hanks was already established as a brilliant actor. He was just so great. The only thing was that he liked to come up with his own lines sometimes. So we'd be like, oh, wait, where is he now? So we would be tracking that. Raleigh Farnsworth, who was our director, would get on his case for that sometimes. One of the funny things I remember was playing Luther Billis. He had to have his shirt open and the crew had painted the chip on his chest. Backstage, it was cold. So he says, I was freezing most of the time. So he wrote that in the yearbook.
What was the audition process like for trying out for the school musical at Skylight?
A serious process. Raleigh Farnsworth was very much a very, very methodical, thoughtful, and observant man. And so Raleigh, as a director, was very serious. Not to the extreme, I'm joking here, but a little bit like Devil Wears Prada. Why isn't everybody ready? It's like, you know, you had to really be ready for your lines. You had to be really prepared. He took this very seriously. He wanted students and thespians to take it seriously. He says, because this is what it's going to be out past high school, so you need to learn this now. We knew who the leads would be, but the question is, can we get in at least with the ensemble? And so I was happy to be able to do that.
Do you remember whether you would have auditioned for Billis?
No, I never auditioned for that. That just wouldn't have fit me at all. Yeah, I'm not that guy. So no, I'm just not. Yeah. And I mean, who else was going to play Luther Billis better than Tom Hanks? I mean, we just didn't have it. I just, you know what I'm saying? He was just the perfect fit. I mean, the moment he started to be on stage, you just knew this guy is special. He's got star quality. It was no surprise. I was still in touch with him through high school. When he went down to do Bosom Buddies, I knew that was it. It was just like no question in my mind.
For the past few decades, Kip's professional career has been in the area of executive coaching, training, and recruitment, with a focus on diversity and inclusivity. He did some theater in college, but didn't pursue it after that.
I just didn't feel like I could take that much rejection, to be honest. I mean, you have to really be tough-skinned. I just didn't see me as that person. So I thought, I'm going to do this for fun, and I'm going to do it on my terms.
Do you ever get the itch to perform again?
Absolutely. So I'm going to turn 65 this coming Tuesday, and I'm planning to sort of really pull back, semi-retire by the time I'm maybe 66 or so. So another more, and then after that, I will absolutely have the time, and I would love to go back to theater. Absolutely. And I go see a lot of it, but one day it would be nice to actually be doing it again.
One surprising development that emerged in the course of our conversation was that Kip had actually held on to the original printed programs from all of his high school plays, including South Pacific. This would be the break in the case I'd been waiting for, which would lead me to a crucial member of the 1974 Skyline cast.
Hold on one second. All right. South Pacific, Buzz Adams, let's see. Buzz Adams, played by Jay Martell. Okay, Jay Martell is a tall, lanky, he was a friend of mine. And so Jay was a funny guy, but if I remember correctly, he put on this very serious coming in and delivering this information. We laughed because we knew who Jay was. Jay was a funny guy playing this super serious moment. And so that's what I remember from that.
So I started looking for this Jay Martell, the guy who played my role, Buzz Adams, alongside Tom Hanks. And I was disappointed to find out that there are a lot of Jay Martells in the world. I was about to give up when I noticed that there was one on Facebook who I had a number of friends in common with. I looked that person up on Twitter and searched for his handle, at Mr. Jay Martell, along with the word Skyline, just to see what would happen. And I found this tweet from December 4th, 2013. I went to Skyline High School with at Colin Hanks's dad, at Tom Hanks. Wonder what happened to him.
I was a sophomore, which is the first year at Skyline.
This is that Jay Martell.
So I was very young, coming into this drama department. I auditioned for Luther Billis, thinking that I was by far the funniest person who auditioned.
I was a freshman, and I had the same mentality. I was like, that's the part I want.
Yeah, I mean, it's the only vaguely funny person in the show. And then this guy named Tom Hanks got the part, which I'm still a little bitter about. But all things considered, I was pretty happy with Lieutenant Buzz Adams. I wasn't familiar with the show, so when I saw my name on the casting sheet, I went straight to the text, and I saw that he had a huge speech in the second act, and I was like, yes, awesome. I wonder if this is a thing that, like, that role is inhabited by the person who just missed out on Luther Billis and is always trying to kind of, like, make it funny when it's not meant to be funny at all.
The reason that Jay and I had mutual friends is that Jay works in show business.
After his performance as Buzz Adams, he would go on to a successful career as a writer, director, producer, showrunner, and only occasionally a performer. His credits include Key and Peele and the Will Ferrell Kevin Hart feature film Get Hard. He's also written two novels, The Present and Channel Blue. But the credit on his CV that caught my attention was the Comedy Central sketch series Alternatino, starring Arturo Castro. I've auditioned for Alternatino.
Oh my God.
More than once. So I thought there's at least a slight chance. I don't know how involved you would have ever been in casting smaller roles within the show.
I was involved in all the casting, so I might have seen tape of you at some point.
You may, that I thought, oh, I have this connection with another Lieutenant Buzz Adams, and I might have actually auditioned for and been rejected by a fellow, a Buzz Adams.
You know, Buzz Adams should not do that to each other. Buzz Adamses should stick together.
It's a very small club of people who've given one little speech that we have in common. I wonder if somewhere on a hard drive you have access to whether there's a Connor Ratliff audition tape.
It would probably be somewhere in my email history.
Right.
I can do a search if you want.
That would be great, yeah.
There is something here from Alternatino. Let's see. You auditioned for, okay, Freddie in Gender Reveal. That was a very, very small part.
Sounds familiar.
You know, I think for those kind of parts, I never watched the tape. I sort of waited for Arturo and the director to weigh in. Yeah. And then when they got down to their kind of like final picks, I would chime in.
It's okay if you're rejecting me. I actually would rather know about it than
not. Oh my God, I just found an email. Wait a second. My first choice for Freddie is Connor.
Is that real?
That's real. I can send you this if you want.
So I was your first choice. This is some real Buzz Adams solidarity without even knowing about it.
Well, you must have had a great audition. And I'm going to have to go down this rabbit hole to find out what happened after that. Did you not get the part?
No, I didn't get the part.
On Arturo's notes, which followed mine, he chooses two different people. And then he said, I love Connor Ratliff, always have. Don't know if this role is enough for him to strut his stuff.
I mean, that's a good rejection because it really puffs up my... It puffs... I don't book the part, but I'm, you know, it's a good feeling. When I first messaged Jay to talk to him about South Pacific, he responded that his experience doing the play was particularly humiliating and suggested that the only reason he wasn't recast was because they had no one to take his place. There was an incident late in the rehearsal process as he was on stage performing Lieutenant Buzz Adams' big speech.
And I started doing it. And I had made several maybe bizarre choices in retrospect, but I was doing it in a Southern accent and I was doing the speech. And then at some point, the director yelled, Jay, you're acting like a duck.
A duck?
Yeah. And I froze. And the conductor of the orchestra, who's also the music teacher, said, you are making a mockery of World War II.
What?
Yeah.
What does that mean? What were you doing? It was just the choices?
I was maybe talking really fast and, you know, doing that kind of thing where, I, you know, like, well, we look and we came around and it was just sort of this outpouring of negativity. I kind of looked around and Tom and the guy playing the commander was just sort of shrugged and we just kept on going on. It was sort of damaging. And then I think for the next year or so, I couldn't get cast in anything through the drama department. Like Lieutenant Buzz Adams scorched my young dramatic career in high school. So,
oh, how did you make changes to your performance based on those notes that you were acting like a duck and making a mockery of World War II?
I think I kind of kept on doing what I was doing, but maybe less so. Later, the drama teacher told me, in regards to just my acting in general, just said, Jay, when I see you up there on the stage, I see H-A-M, a ham.
It's weird to think back on,
you know, whatever impulse you might have had, you know, being identified as hammy or goofy or anything like that, that they didn't try to, like, give you more constructive notes first for someone who was comfortable performing and maybe fun and funny. You know, that you could maybe just try asking, like, hey, can we try this a different way? Maybe do it like this or like that. Because any student like that might be two notes away from being exactly the kind of actor that they would like. You don't need to humiliate them.
Yeah.
Now, you wrote an essay on South Pacific that was in the program.
Yes, I did.
How did that come about?
I don't know. I think it was the choir teacher who thought the show needed some explaining. I needed a frame of reference. So she had an essay contest. And that was the one thing I could do well in high school, was write essays. I don't really remember the essay. That's funny. I remember it was something about how, like, it was from a different time, but it was still valuable or something like that.
I actually think it's pretty good. I think most school plays should get the best essayist in their school to write about the play. South Pacific is a wartime drama. It reflects, as dramas do, the feelings of its time when this country was pitted against a faraway enemy of mysterious evil. Good, bad, protagonist, antagonist, then all had clear-cut meanings, now diluted by government scandals and a newer consciousness. Do we really know now who the enemy is?
Oh, that is so 16 years old. I will say in my defense, that was the fall after Nixon had resigned as a result of Watergate. So just putting that out there.
It's also just interesting to me that a student who was accused of making a mockery of World War II was allowed to write an essay in the program.
I think the essay was written first, before that critique of my acting came to be. I think a lot of us spend a big part of our childhood just like, you know, settle down, knock it off, stop being ridiculous. No, it's just what we fought against all our lives. And then part of the thrill of actually finding kindred spirits who want to do the same thing, you know, it's a big deal.
It's like you asked in your essay, do we know really? Do we really know who the enemy is? That's a question we got to keep asking.
I think you've pulled it all together, Connor.
I think I might have, you know? It might all be, the circle is complete.
Indeed.
I think Dead Eyes could work as a stage musical.
Yes.
Absolutely. It does have a... It has the I want. There's a very clear I want there.
Yeah, and a very clear I don't want. or I guess it would be, I guess to stay positive, Tom Hanks character would have a song about I want someone else to play this character.
I got to meet Tom Hanks at the Oscars last year, the pre-pandemic Oscars, 2020. Kristen didn't, because we tried to figure out why she didn't. She was at another thing getting to meet John Williams, my hero.
Right. I got to be on stage with John Williams while Bobby got to
get her picture taken with him and have him say nice things to her.
But you got to meet Tom Hanks. So.
That's true.
I feel sorry for neither of you. These are both wonderful.
And I remember he was wearing clear glasses frames. I was like, oh, that's, everyone's wearing those now. Now Tom Hanks has those clear plastic glass frames.
Do you wear those, Connor? Mm-hmm. Is that another thing you would possibly have in common with him?
I don't. I have just regular frame glasses that I wear occasionally. But I'm open to it. I'm open to it. I don't want to start single white femaling Tom Hanks, because I don't think that would be a good look for me to start. It's already weird enough that I do this podcast. I don't think I need to start actively making choices that... because here's the thing. Tom Hanks was the Billis. You know, he got the... And you can't picture anyone better in a high school production of that than high school senior Tom Hanks.
Do you have a feeling in your heart of like, God damn it, he even got Billis?
A little bit, but also there's... There's also the sense of everybody sort of finds their spot. And so far, everything in my experience tells me that I'm the Lieutenant Buzz Adams. That
that's the place that I occupy.
You are the Emile Debeck of Dead Eyes. You have four wives and eight kids, and you've killed a man.
Or like he could even be the Nellie Forbush.
Yeah, but never the Billis. Never the Billis. Tom Hanks is always the Billis. There is an aspect to which you find the place that you fit. And I feel like Tom Hanks was destined to be that guy who's the successful senior playing the funny part. And, you know, being the Buzz to Tom Hanks, you know, that's something that as the Toy Story films have demonstrated, being the Buzz is not, that's not, there's no shame in that.
No shame.
A Buzz can find equal footing if I need to. Now, you guys had said that you have your own Dead Eyes stories.
I guess the biggest one was we spent 10 years writing this musical that was kind of based on me, like the main character. And it was all about how his mind worked, and all the other characters on stage were characters in his mind. And when we finally got it on its feet and we're sitting in the audience, we realized that the audience didn't like him and neither did I.
Wow.
It was that was a rough moment. I do remember Bobby.
And they came and reviewed it and killed it.
That's a big personal moment to have in a public way.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, there was like $1 million budget to give Bobby this mirror moment.
I think throughout history, I think that's one of the more common experiences, whether it's true or not, that people reach a point where they're like, nobody else likes me, and I don't like me either. Very few of them involve a show. You know, like at the center of that realization. That's remarkable. What was the title of that one?
It was called Up Here. And it was from the point of view of an introverted, complicated 30-something's mind. Yeah, it was a rough moment.
Do you ever return to it and look at it as like, I'm working on myself?
Well, I didn't want to work on it for a really long time. There was a lot of pressure to fix it and put the show back up and figure out what was wrong with it. And I just didn't want to look at it. I wanted to just focus on something else. I just wanted to avoid it. You know, everything, every piece of culture is part of this lens that we see the world through, and we all forget that we're looking through the lens, and then one day something will happen and all of a sudden you'll see this lens and everything else looks different through the new lens, and that's what we're all dealing with, I guess.
For the past few years, I've been looking at the world through a very specific lens. One that's designed to accentuate even the slightest connection between me and Tom Hanks. It's a distorted lens, obviously. It would have to be for me to talk for a whole episode about how he and I were in the same high school musical 16 years and 2,000 miles apart. But to some extent, everybody's lens is a little distorted. Elise Ducats looks back and sees that young Tom Hanks was just one out of many talented students she taught. But Kip Lacer recalls a classmate who was clearly destined for greatness. Even Bobby and Kristen, when I talked to them, their Dead Eyes story sounded like the kind of failure that would haunt them for the rest of their careers. But just a few months after we talked, I saw an article in the trades that Up Here, the semi-autobiographical musical they described as having been killed, is now being turned into an 8-episode series for Hulu. Everything looks different through a new lens. 70 years ago, South Pacific was about as successful as a work of art could be, popular with audiences and critics alike. Some of its virtues have faded with time, and its flaws might be more apparent through the lens of 2022. And that's not a bad thing. It actually lines up really well with the core themes of that musical. That change and growth are difficult, but worth it. I've changed what I think a Dead Eyes story is. I used to think of it as primarily being about failure and disappointment. But I now think that there's a flip side to it, and that's the part that happens after you fail, when you keep trying. When someone tells you you're going to run out of ideas, and you worry that they could be right, but then you go on to make 30 more episodes. There was also the second piece of negative feedback that I received early on when I was developing the podcast, and that was when they said, "We don't think you'll ever get to talk to Tom Hanks." And my response to that was twofold. On the one hand, so what? Maybe I won't. That's not the point of all this. I'm trying to say something larger about how, in this life, things don't always turn out the way we want them to, and that sucks, but you have to find the best way of dealing with it if you can.
Hello, hey, I'm Tom.
But on the other hand, maybe I will get to talk to Tom Hanks.
Hi there, Connor.
Connor, how are you?
I'm doing okay.
Yeah?
Yeah.
You are?
I am, yeah.
Next episode, the very special season 3 finale of Dead Eyes, featuring Tom Hanks. I couldn't be more pleased to be having this conversation.
Well, do you want
to
trip me or hug me? Do you want to punch me or kiss me?
I guess I'm going to skirt right to the basic, the heart of the matter.
I think we should.
They served you champagne like a hero. When you landed, someone carried your bag. From here on out, your patience zero. Smelling ether as they hand you the rag. Life is good, you look around and think I'm in the right neighborhood. But honey, you just moved in. Life is grand, and wouldn't you like to have it go as planned? Go as planned. Hip, hip, hooray.
Dead Eyes is a production of HeadGum Studios. It was created by me, Connor Ratliff. It's written by me, and it's mostly me that you hear talking, including now. Our producers are Harry Nelson and Mike Comite, and our associate producer is Jordan Allen. Special thanks to my guests, Bobby Lopez and Kristen Anderson Lopez, Dr. Jonathan Craighead, Elise Dukatz, Kip Lacer, and Jay Martell. Also, thanks to Alicia McGeorge Campbell, Mark Baumgartner, and Carol Craighead for helping me acquire photos and video of the 1990 JC High School production of South Pacific. Also, thanks to Amy Mann for letting us use the song that's playing in the background. It's called Patient Zero, and it can be found on her Grammy-winning 2017 album, Mental Illness. If you like Dead Eyes, please do all the things that podcasts tell you to do. Subscribe, rate, review, follow us on Twitter at Dead Eyes Podcast, and talk about us nicely on social media. If you want to reach out, the email is deadeyespodcast@gmail.com. Please tell your friends about this show, especially if you are friends with anyone who would like to hear me talk with Tom Hanks in our next episode. Thanks for listening. Be smart. Stay safe. See you next week.
Was a HeadGum original.